This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Since 1965, the Voting Rights Act has required state and local governments in 16 states to get approval from the Justice Department before they change election procedures. The idea is to ensure that places with a history of racial discrimination do not reestablish Jim Crow. Now the Supreme Court is deciding whether we still need the Voting Rights Act in the age of President Obama and whether it's unfair to require some states to follow procedures not applied to all. The Voting Rights Act covers all of 9 states, most of them in the Deep South, plus Arizona, Alaska, and Texas, and parts of 7 more, including New York and California. Joining us now is Bill Ferguson, chairman of the District Board of Canyon Creek, Texas, the community whose case was argued before the court this week. He's with us from a studio in Austin. Nice to have you with us today.
Thank you, Neil.
And I understand Canyon Creek is a relatively new community of 3,500 people or so, which didn't exist before 1980 and has no history of racial discrimination.
That's correct. Canyon Creek was created more than 2 decades ago by a developer. He created Northwest Austin Metropolitan Utility District Number 1 to sell bonds and to install water, wastewater facilities. And the board is controlled by 5 board members located in the community and elected from the community.
And were you surprised to learn the Voting Rights Act applied to you?
We were. Neil, I was elected to the board 6 years ago, and voting at that time was held in a neighbor's garage. And shortly after, members of the community gained control of the board from the developer. We we asked our attorney to move the polling place from the garage to the elementary school and make the polling take place at the same time as the general election, so that the community would be able to easily vote for the board members that they would choose for this particular district.
Mm-hmm. And you were told, in fact, you had to get pre-approval for that change from the Justice Department.
That's exactly right. Our attorney informed us that we were subject to oversight from the Justice Department, and we had to ask for their approval to move it from the garage to the school.
Do you regard this as, I think as the lawyer for you explained it in the Supreme Court, do you regard this as a scarlet letter that effectively labels your community as presumptively racist?
Well, it certainly suggests that we need oversight when, in fact, we don't. We're a very progressive community. We're composed of a number of ethnic groups live in the community. We openly encourage voting. We've taken steps to encourage voting, and we just don't see that we need oversight by the Justice Department.
Are there places that you think outside of Canyon Creek, other places where the Voting Rights Act should be applied?
Perhaps so, but not by the blanket that they threw over us with Section 5, which encompasses Texas and most of the southeastern United States. I personally just don't think it's appropriate anymore for groups like us to be under their oversight.
So you think we're past this, institutionalized racism, at least in terms of election laws, not a problem anymore?
Well, I think we're certainly moving in that direction. Certainly, if the Justice Department could recognize places that need their direct oversight and remove groups like ourselves that don't need their oversight, then certainly that would seem more appropriate than the way in which the law was originally written.
Bill Ferguson, thanks for your time today. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
And good luck before the court. Bill Ferguson, chairman of the District Court of Canyon Creek, the community whose case was argued before the Supreme Court last week. So what do you think? Do we still need the Voting Rights Act? Give us a call. Our phone number, 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our website. That's at npr.org. Just click on Talk of the Nation. Joining us now is Chris Ward. His law firm represents Bill Ferguson in Canyon Creek. He was at the Supreme Court last week during oral arguments. He's also with us today from Austin. And nice to have you on the program as well.
Thank you, Neil. It's good to be here.
And I just wanted you to expand on Bill Ferguson's argument. This applies to all of 9 states and parts of 7 more. Why should those states at this point, Congress just 3 years ago reapproved this law by overwhelming margins?
One thing I'd like to clarify a little, because you've been referring to, quote, the Voting Rights Act, unquote. Mm-hmm. This lawsuit does not involve the entire Voting Rights Act. The Voting Rights Act is a large piece of legislation, most of which is permanent, nationwide, and prohibits actual discrimination in voting. This particular section, which is known as Section 5 of the Act, or the preclearance provision, really singles out certain jurisdictions that were 40 years ago were known to be real problems. In 2006, when Congress renewed this law, one of the things that it failed to do was make any update to the formula that these jurisdictions are covered under. The formula hasn't been updated since 1975, and it relies on data going back to the 1972 presidential election and earlier.
And you know as well as I do that the some numbers have been updated, and there's dispute about this, and that was one of the issues
Well, there's no dispute.
It was one of the issues argued before the court. I just wanted to ask you, just on a broader question, I know one of your arguments is this applies selectively to nine states, all of nine states, parts of seven others. Some states, why are some states being picked out, you say, in this day and age?
Sorry, there's actually no dispute that the coverage formula only goes up to 1972. That's black and white written in the law. And this law continues to look to the past. In 1965, this law addressed a specific problem. That was jurisdictions trying to stay one step ahead of federal courts and trying to circumvent the efforts of the Justice Department to squelch civil rights abuses.
Mm-hmm.
And the evidence that Congress had before it in 2006 showed that this particular type of problem no longer exists, certainly not at a systematic, pervasive level. No one's arguing that there are no longer any problems with regard to discrimination in voting nationwide, but the problems that exist now, as the record Congress had before it revealed, are both isolated and not confined to the states that are covered by Section 5.
So this is unfair, then, to hold these places to procedures that other places are not required to be held to.
That's right, Neil. It is unfair, especially because most of these jurisdictions have demonstrated a record over the past several decades of improvement and progress. Very importantly, the officials that are now in place in these jurisdictions are not the same people who were violating civil rights in 1965. And most of these people were put in place under this system. Section 5, since it's operated in 1965, we think that it's had an effect and helped improve conditions. So the officials you're talking about were selected in a free and fair and democratic system. And these are the same officials that you're now saying we don't trust these officials that local people elected in free and fair elections.
We're talking with Chris Ward, one of the attorneys for the Northwest Austin Municipal District Number 1, Canyon Creek, Texas. He argued he was at the Supreme Court last week for oral arguments in the case about the Voting Rights Act, Section 5. Do we still need this section of the Voting Rights Act? 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. And Dee's calling from Charlotte, North Carolina.
Yes, sir. Hi. I'm enjoying the show.
Thank you.
I really think that we should maintain this law. I think it was a couple weeks ago I heard that there was a study made where over 2,400 cases of people trying to sabotage the voting rights of others was clocked because of this Section 5. Now, it's kind of like I've raised six children, and I know I went through a period where they accused me of not trusting them. And my thing was, I tell you what, just do what you're supposed to do, be where you're supposed to be, and there won't be a question of trust. And I think that's what Section 5 does. It kind of keeps us honest, and I think long-term, it's a good thing. It's like a stoplight that saved lives, and so now that the death count has come down, we say, well, let's remove the light now because we no longer need it. I disagree with that. I think let's keep Section 5 in effect, and we won't have any problems.
45 years, not long enough to earn that trust?
No, because as I say, just recently they gathered about 2,400 cases of people trying to sabotage the voting rights laws. So I say let's keep it there because it was put there for honesty. So let's stay honest.
Chris Ward, your response?
Well, I'm not sure where that 2400 figure is coming from. It may stretch back the entire 45-year history of the law. The most recent figures that Congress had before it and that we've seen in this case are about 700 objections since 1982, so that's over 25 years, and most of those are at least 15 or 20 years old. And many of those, the Supreme Court has said the Justice Department should not have objected to in the first place. So what the numbers have shown is actually that the number of changes that go through the preclearance process that the Justice Department has to object to as potentially discriminatory is almost zero. It's literally less than a tenth of a percent. And this is out of thousands upon thousands of changes, like moving a polling place from someone's garage to the local public school, that go through this process every year.
And the argument was also made that the reason that number is so low, perhaps, is because there's a deterrent effect. People know they have to submit these changes to the Justice Department, so they don't make illegal ones.
Well, Chief Justice Roberts compared that argument to an elephant whistle, that you say, look how good my elephant whistle works. I'm blowing it, and there are no elephants around.
Well, what about Dee's stoplight analogy? Just because road deaths are down, do we now remove the stoplight?
Well, that analogy doesn't quite hold up, because what this law really does is shift the balance between the federal government and local government. It's a constitutional structural issue. So it's not as simple as a stoplight. This literally puts the federal government on the city council or in the state legislature. And there was justification for that in 1965 when these jurisdictions showed they couldn't be trusted. But now we've had more than four decades of progress.
Okay. And I'm, like the Supreme Court, I have to blow a whistle here. Dee, thank you very much for your phone call. And Chris Ward, thank you very much for your time today. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Neil.
Chris Ward was one of the attorneys for the Northwest Austin Municipal District No. 1 who was at last week's oral arguments on the Voting Rights Act Section 5 before the United States Supreme Court. When we come back, we'll hear from Lonnie Guinier. Stay with us. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Last week, the Supreme Court heard a challenge to a key part of the Voting Rights Act of 1965. The argument? Times have changed. With an African-American in the White House, some argue the act is no longer needed. What do you think? Do we still need the Voting Rights Act? Give us a call, 800-989-8255. Send us email, talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation at our website. Go to npr.org, click on Talk of the Nation. Joining us now is Harvard Law Professor Lonnie Guinier, who served as assistant counsel for the NAACP Legal Defense Fund and was special assistant in the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department in the Carter administration. Lonnie Guinier joins us today from a studio on the campus at Stanford University in California, and it's nice to have you back on Talk of the Nation today.
Thanks for having me.
And we're asking listeners today if they think we still need the Voting Rights Act with an African-American in the White House. Virginia, one of the states covered, was the first to elect an African-American governor since Reconstruction. Do you think we still need the Voting Rights Act, Section 5?
I certainly do, and I think that Congress made that judgment after carefully studying the issue. It held hearings over 10 months, 21 hearings, and voted almost unanimously, both in the Senate and in the House, to extend the Voting Rights Act, and to extend it in particular for 25 years, because, as Republican James Sensenbrenner said, it was most important to have this act in place for the round of redistricting, where the Voting Rights Act has played a very important and powerful role in keeping the incumbent politicians honest.
And yet those very small numbers cited by Chris Ward a moment ago, the number of times the Justice Department has overruled somebody, and those numbers seem to be diminishing with time.
Well, I think your response was the right one. Although there were 600 objections, 60% of which were for intentional acts of discrimination, you can't count the effectiveness of the act simply based on counting the number of objections, because the act has a deterrent effect. People don't do certain things that they otherwise would, knowing that someone is watching over their shoulder.
And what would you tell Bill Ferguson, the man from Canyon Creek, Texas, a community that didn't exist when the Voting Rights Act was created in 1965? And he says, we have no record of discrimination. Why does this affect us?
Well, I would say to him that he's actually not paying any price for the Voting Rights Act because, as I understand it, the district that he represents has contracted out its voting election, its election laws and implementation to Travis County. And so Travis County is, in fact, submitting any of the changes. The Namudno district has not submitted a change for preclearance since 2004. And even when it did submit changes, it only cost about $233 a year for that small district to comply with the Voting Rights Act, Section 5.
And that's the cost. And when you said Namudno, that's Northwest Austin Municipal District
right.
Number
Sorry.
One. And these things get shorthanded in as these cases go through the court system. It's just a couple of $100. But nevertheless, what about that stain, that presumptive assumption that they're racists?
I don't think there's any presumption that anybody is racist because you have jurisdictions in New York and in California that are also covered. The point is that the coverage formula works to identify jurisdictions that have a history of intentional discrimination, and it has worked successfully to deter those jurisdictions from, as one of your other callers said, running a stoplight. So the fact that you've had this stoplight in place for a number of years and people are now slowing down suggests that it's effective, not that you need to remove the stoplight.
Let's see if we get some callers in on the conversation. Again, our conversation is this with Lani Guinier, a professor of law at Harvard and a longtime civil rights attorney. 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. We'll go to Leon. Leon with us from Athens, Ohio.
Yes, Neil, thanks for taking my call. And hello, Ms. Guinier.
Hello.
My comment is I believe that it's absolutely necessary to keep it in place. While I'm sympathetic to what strides that have been made in certain communities, and I think we need to applaud those and make sure that those are publicized, because it does say that there are communities that have changed and have adapted to time. But I think modern-day attempts to disenfranchise certain ethnic groups have been cloaked in the redistricting acts that have been facilitated through these states' rights. And
when you say redistricting, redrawing state senate, state assembly, and congressional districts, that sort of thing?
Absolutely, and especially in Ohio, it had an effect on both presidential, the last two presidential elections. So if it was not in certain groups, certain candidates would have won even more overwhelmingly or lost more severely, and this state plays a pivotal role in that. So I think it's absolutely necessary to stay in place.
And
I'll listen to your comment.
All right, Leon, thanks very much for the phone call. Lani Guinier, I'm sure you have an answer for him, but also I don't think Ohio's covered by this section of the Voting Rights Act, and that goes to one of the other arguments of the people who brought this suit. Why are we just targeting these nine states and parts of seven others? Why not the whole country?
Well, I think that the NAACP Legal Defense Fund attorney who argued the case in court explained that very well. He said there's a record of persistent and adaptive violations among a group of essentially repeat offenders. And Congress was in a position, in the best position, certainly better than the Supreme Court, to analyze the evidence and to declare, as it did almost unanimously, that this is still good public policy. So the fact that in Ohio, if blacks or Latinos or other voters feel that the redistricting policies that the state and legislators are adopting are in fact unfair, they have to resort to a very expensive process of filing a federal lawsuit, whereas in places like Mississippi or Louisiana, Louisiana and North Carolina, states where, and Mississippi, where they are covered and where the representatives from those jurisdictions filed a brief saying that they should still remain covered because they understand that the act is playing a very powerful role. And there was testimony in the record that in order to file a preclearance request, it takes you about 30 minutes, especially if it's routine. So it's not an encumbrance. It's not that burdensome, and it's doing a lot of good.
Let's go next to Jim, and Jim's with us from Columbia, South Carolina.
Hello, Neil.
Jim, how you doing?
I'm doing good. I'm Jim Felder, and I head the South Carolina Voter Education Project. It's one of those old projects that grew out of the 1965 Voting Rights Act, and we still have it in South Carolina. As we speak, the South Carolina legislature is debating a bill that would limit the time that persons can vote. Presently, we have a 30-day window through absentee ballot, mail-in, or walk-in. We had such a large turnout this last time that some young legislators, some young Republican white legislators, don't want to see that happen again. So now they want to close that window to 3 days of early voting as opposed to the 30 days that was there. So as we say, Jim Crow might be dead in the South, but Jim Crow Esquire is alive and well.
Why would that disproportionately affect minorities and African Americans in particular?
It would disproportionately because we don't have enough time to vote. As it stands now, you've had 30 days with the absentee ballot. We don't call it early voting in South Carolina. You can vote absentee by mail 30 days out, or you can go into your local area and vote at the local local registration office. They call it absentee. They don't call it early voting. Well, they want to close down that 30-day period where you can walk in and cast your vote and limit it just to mail-in. They have forgotten they've got to get it pre-cleared. I've argued with them they need to get it pre-cleared before they go forward, but they're pressing on anyway.
Lonnie, can I ask Jim a question?
Go ahead, Lonnie.
Is he still on the line? What are the hours that the polls are open on Election Day?
7 to 7.
Right. So I think that's an answer, Neil, to your question. What's the effect on people of color and other poor people? Is if you have a job and you have to work a 12-hour shift, if you're limited to voting on Election Day, you're not going to be able to vote.
But he's saying there's another 3-day period where you can mail in your vote.
No, they want to cut it to 3 days.
Yes, right. Even under if this law was passed and approved.
From 30 to just 3 days.
Right, but that's basically saying that we want to discourage people from voting,
thank
not
you.
That we want to make
exactly
it possible for as many people as are interested in voting.
Well, it'd be interesting to see, Jim, if this ends up in court, too, if they don't put it before the Justice Department. I assume it will. So good luck to you. Jim, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Here's an email that we have. This from Jonathan in Flint, Michigan. This is a perfect example, he writes, of the federal government overstepping its boundaries. There is a trend that is still prevalent today that allows the state sovereignty to be impeded in the name of civil rights, even when the legislation is poorly written. It's a shame that states have given up so much of their rights. When did the federal government become expert in racial equality?
Is that a question?
I guess it is. Well, it has a question mark at the end of it.
If you are comparing the commitment of the federal government to the commitment of the covered jurisdiction, there's no question that without the involvement of the federal government, whether it was through Brown versus Board of Education, the Supreme Court, whether it was through President Eisenhower sending in the troops to desegregate the schools in Little Rock, whether it was through the adoption of the Voting Rights Act in 1965 or the Civil Rights laws of 1964, it has required the intervention of the federal government to get many of these so-called sovereign states to realize that they didn't win the Civil War.
Let's see if we get another caller on the line, and let's go to David. David with us from Palm Beach County in Florida.
Good afternoon, and thank you, Neil, for allowing me to speak.
Go ahead, please.
I'm interested in knowing about the harm that was claimed before the Supreme Court in oral argument last week by the jurisdiction in Texas and any other jurisdiction that had an opportunity to speak to the court, and why at least four of the members of the court were receptive to those claims of harm.
Lonnie Guinier, do you have an answer for him?
Well, I think that's an excellent question. I really appreciate your raising it. The harm is the inconvenience of having to pre-clear their changes in election laws, and it turns out that inconvenience is quite de minimis. And then the second harm is the argument that somehow they're being stigmatized because they have to participate in this very routine process that, as one of the witnesses before the Congress said, takes about 30 minutes in terms of filing the preclearance request, and it can be done very informally. You can call up the Justice Department. It's not a time-consuming procedure. But the Supreme Court, at least four members, has suggested a certain sympathy to the question of federalism rather than to the question of the equal right to vote in a democracy. So they are inclined to defer to the sovereignty of the states rather than to the sovereignty of each individual voter. On the other hand, the Supreme Court as a whole has considered the federalism challenge four times and each time has upheld the constitutionality of Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act because of a record of persistent and adaptive violations by the covered jurisdictions. So if the court were to find that Section 5 is unconstitutional based on the claims made by Nemudno, the utility district that brought the case, then I would say we basically have five judicial activists on the Supreme Court, and they're all on the conservative side.
Well, if I may ask one other question. If the court does, in fact, strike down this section, will it be up to each state then to enact an identical or very similar law in order to protect voters' rights?
It could be that each state could enact laws, but it could also be that Congress could change the coverage formula so that it would conform to what the Supreme Court seemed to want, which is a nationwide coverage formula, which, in my view, is completely inefficient because it will just overload the Justice Department with all kinds of routine objections, and then by doing that will undermine the effectiveness of the act in the places where it's most needed.
David, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate
Thank
it.
Thank you.
We're talking with Lonnie Guinier about the case before the Supreme Court, which seeks to strike down a section of the Voting Rights Act of 1965. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe just two of the states that are covered by Section 5 filed amicus briefs, friends of the court with the people bringing the suit, and several of the states covered by the act, those required to go through these procedures, sided with the government, saying this is something we should keep.
That's absolutely right. Mississippi, Louisiana, and North Carolina all signed on to a brief saying that being a covered state was not burdensome.
Let's get one more caller on the line. This is Greg. Greg with us from Chico, California.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I think that we need to keep the laws in place, but I think there should be a modification with states that have shown complicity to the law. I have to say, in listening to the gentleman that was on speaking from Texas who brought the case, I even though there was a demureness in the way that they brought the case, his pause at a question makes me wonder what's really behind them even bringing the case. You know, the gentleman that was talking about South Carolina, obviously South Carolina still has some issues, so they should still be under the articles. In California, where I live, I haven't heard of many cases where voting rights were being hampered.
So, Lonnie Guinier, should there be a process by which either counties or municipalities or states could get out from under this if they've shown compliance?
There is such a process, and in fact, a number of jurisdictions in Virginia have bailed out. It's called the bailout provision. So if, in fact, a jurisdiction has a history of compliance and a history of no objections, it is eligible to file a bailout. So there is that process already in the law.
And if, Greg, let me thank you for your call. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
As most analysts say, this is going to come down to one vote in the United States Supreme Court, and that's Justice Kennedy. Any indication as you read his questions and his inquiries as to which way you think he might cast his vote?
I really don't think Justice Kennedy wants to be known as the justice who threw out or declared unconstitutional the crown jewel of American civil rights laws. But there may be an effort to narrow the particular claim or to remand it back to the lower court to review some marginal issues. That's my hope, anyway.
In other words, the Supreme Court would say, we can't decide this because of the following questions that has yet to be resolved. We're sending it back to the lower court?
That's the worst-case scenario, in my view. Obviously, if they declare it unconstitutional, I think that, as I said, they will be ignoring four different precedents in which the court has, in fact, considered this federalism challenge and each time has upheld the constitutionality of Section 5.
Lonnie Guinier, thank you for your time today. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Lonnie Guinier, professor of law at Harvard, with us today from a studio on the campus at Stanford University in Palo Alto, California, where she's spending this semester. Coming up, how to fix the economy. The Federal Reserve already cut rates to zero. What else can they do? Economist Greg Mankiw has one idea: negative interest rates. He'll explain in just a moment. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.